From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A Memphis jury has ruled that Martin Luther King's assassination was a conspiracy. We'll talk with civil rights leader Reverend James Lawson and William Pepper, lawyer for the King family, and James Earl Ray. This week, the governing general counsel of the World Trade Organization will meet in Geneva to consider its next steps after the failure of the WTO meeting in Seattle. We'll speak with some of the organizers of the People's Protest. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Government representatives are holding a three-day meeting in Geneva to assess progress in implementing the 1996 PAC banning the use and transfer of undetectable anti-personnel mines. The 37-member pact, which came into force in December of 98, also requires all mines to be self-destructing unless they're in clearly marked and guarded areas. For many countries, it's been overtaken by the 97 Ottawa Treaty to ban all landmines, but big landmine producers, notably in the United States, Russia, China, India, and Pakistan, have not signed the Ottawa Accord. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Syrian Foreign Minister Farouk Chaouch will meet in Washington, D.C. to resume peace talks that have been on hold for the past 4 years. Republican presidential candidates are conducting another in a series of debates, this one to be held in Des Moines, Iowa tonight. The candidates participating in the debate are Gary Bauer, George Bush, Steve Forbes, Orrin Hatch, Alan Keyes, and John McCain. Walmart, the world's largest retailer, is believed to be talking to America Online, the biggest internet access provider, about an alliance to market each other's goods and services. Billionaires Ted Turner and Bill Gates are saying they will help the World Health Organization meet its goal of eradicating polio by the end of next year. The United Nations Foundation, a Turner charity, announced it will donate $28 million toward eradication of polio. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, a charity set up by the software tycoon, will give an additional $50 million. When Nelson Mandela talked with his country's young people about the risks of AIDS and the need for taking precautions during sexual contact, he was accused of promoting promiscuity, but he said the subject of AIDS must be addressed in a country of 40 million, where at least 4 million are infected. Mandela was the last to speak at Friday's Global Health Forum in Seattle, following short presentations by his wife, Graca Machel, and Microsoft Corporation co-founder Bill Gates and others. Bill Gates and his wife, Melinda, have pledged $30 million to charities founded by Mandela and his wife, Michelle. This news from Dallas, Texas. The Immigration and Naturalization Service has jailed nearly 300 foreigners for more than 3 years, including some people never convicted of a crime in the United States. This according to the Dallas Morning News. Some have been jailed for arriving with inadequate travel documents. Some of those who've been convicted of crimes in this country, the INS says the majority have serious criminal histories, are being held despite having completed their prison sentences. Until 1996, foreigners ordered deported generally could be held for a maximum of 6 months, but the law now requires the INS to indefinitely detain foreigners who pose a flight risk or a public safety threat until they can be removed from the United States. A panel of five federal judges recently ruled the agency violates foreigners' fundamental right to due process by holding people indefinitely. This news from Nashville, Texas. Lawyers for convicted Tennessee child killer Robert Coe are facing a court deadline today for arguing he's mentally unfit to be executed. Coe's lawyers thought they wouldn't have to raise the competency issue until all his other appeals had been exhausted. They missed Friday's deadline, but the state Supreme Court has extended it to today. This news from Washington. Two Congress members who just returned from a visit to Africa urged the United Nations to back up peacekeeping efforts in Sierra Leone with an international embargo on black market diamonds. Despite a ceasefire, rebels financed in part by diamond exports continue their attack on civilians, including atrocities against children. This according to Congressmember Tony Hall, Democrat of Ohio, and Frank Wolf, a Republican of Virginia. And a black judge from Virginia filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against the Los Angeles Police Department, alleging officers racially motivated when they stopped a car and left her handcuffed on the ground for nearly a half hour. The suit, filed Friday, contends the officers used unreasonable force and seeks unspecified damages for racially motivated bias. Judge A.C. Willis of Portsmouth, Virginia, said she and two friends were stopped by police with drawn guns for no reason on July 3rd. They were searched, handcuffed, and made to lie face down on hot pavement for nearly 30 minutes before they were released without explanation.
Cards at the window. The only thing from this train that will ever be found. Little lambs that trust what they're told. Every night die out in the cold. Time to turn this train around.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Last week, a Memphis jury found a widespread government conspiracy responsible for the assassination of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. The King family filed a suit against Lloyd Jowers, a retired Memphis businessman who claimed on national television 6 years ago that he paid someone other than James Earl Ray to kill King in Memphis of 1968. Jowers claimed he became involved at the behest of a friend who was working for a mafia boss in New Orleans. Ray confessed to the killing in 1969 but recanted and spent the rest of his life trying to prove his innocence. He died in prison last year. Well, a U.S. House committee concluded in 1978 that Ray killed King, but may have had help from a small group of racists before or after the murder. The committee found no government involvement. The Kings were represented by William Pepper, who was James Earl Ray's lawyer, and has for years claimed that the assassination was the result of a vast conspiracy involving the FBI, the CIA, Army, organized crime, and various state and local officials. Pepper claims King was targeted because of his opposition to the Vietnam War and plans to bring thousands of poor people to Washington for a march. The jury found that Jowers was liable in King's death and that unnamed others, including government agencies, were involved. It awarded the King family $100, the token amount requested in the suit. The King family said the verdict justified its belief that a conspiracy was at the heart of the assassination. We're joined right now by two people, William Pepper, the former attorney for James Earl Ray, an attorney for the King family, and Reverend James Lawson. He testified at the trial, civil rights pioneer and pastor of the Holman United Methodist Church in Santa Monica, California. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!, and let's begin with William Pepper. Can you summarize the significance of last week's verdict in Memphis?
I think it requires that history be rewritten in terms of this case. Like, for this is the first jury to have heard all of the evidence that we've developed over a period of many years, and they heard over 70 witnesses. The range of the plaintiff's case went from details about the scene of the crime, the murder weapon, controller, Raoul, the controller of James Earl Ray, to the involvement of federal agents, their presence in Memphis, and their involvement in the assassination, and, of course, the 31-year cover-up, which is in the details of that cover-up and how it's been orchestrated. I think, effectively, history has been rewritten. This is the only jury that has taken this evidence on board, been able to hear it and consider it, and it took them about an hour to deliberate. After 4 weeks of trial, it took them 1 hour to deliberate. As one of them said at the end of the trial, it was cut and dried. I think history now must be rewritten in terms of how Martin King was assassinated.
Explain exactly who Lloyd Jowers was, William Pepper.
He is a cafe, small-time sort of cafe owner. He owned Jim's Grill, which backed onto a brush area with heavily foliaged area that overlooked the Lorraine Motel, and it was from the back of his restaurant where the fatal shot was fired. He was greatly indebted to Frank Liberto, who was a mafia operative and an associate of Carlos Marcello in Memphis, and Liberto approached him and put the arm on him to participate and facilitate the assassination.
Why didn't Lloyd Jowers testify in this civil suit?
He was ill after the first week, and he was out of court. And we had planned to call him as the next-to-last witness, and he simply was unable to attend court. We then were going to go take his testimony at his bedside, and he sent word through his counsel that that in any event he was going to plead the Fifth Amendment to critical questions. So that seemed to be a waste of the court's time, and what we decided to do was to use an extensive deposition that we had taken quite some while ago, which incorporated his 1993 admissions into the record. I think that's probably the best that we could. He was heavily questioned, interrogated at that time. To say that he wasn't examined, of course, as some pundits have done, is simply not true. But we would have been delighted to call him, and we're prepared to do so.
Reverend James Lawson, why did you testify in this civil trial?
Well, number one, I was chair of the strategy committee for the sanitation strike in 1968 when I was then a pastor in Memphis. And secondly, I was the primary person who negotiated with Dr. King to come to Memphis on the various times that he came, especially the first time. And thirdly, Attorney Pepper wanted me to give some of the context of why Dr. King was there, some of the things that I felt were suspicious in 68-69 as I watched in Memphis the case against James Earl Ray unfold. And that reminds me, Amy, that the L.A. Times reported after the trial last week that James Earl Ray had confessed, but it's my position that plea bargaining does not necessarily entail a confession of anything. And in the case of James Earl Ray, in the transcript at least, he simply said he pled guilty according to the plea bargaining. And it's my judgment that anyone who looks at that period of history in America will see that he was indeed coerced and pressured by a number of things to plea bargain. And that's very typical of the criminal justice system today. You know, many people, poor and otherwise, who are caught in the system are often charged in such a fashion and then kept in jail and pressured until they decide that their best course of action is to say, yes, I'm guilty to that, and then go on, serve their time, and get out.
Reverend Lawson, what did you find suspicious at the time of King's assassination?
Well, from April the 4th, there were suspicious things. number one, the police disappeared from around the motel. They ostensibly were there for surveillance and giving security to King and his party. Number two, the lieutenant who was in the fire station across the street adjacent with a good view of the balcony and all, he was called off saying that there was a threat against his life about an hour before. So, in fact, there was no police surveillance or security around the motel, which probably would have prevented anyone doing the assassination from leaving that area. That's one illustration. Then we discovered on April the 4th, the police radio band had a false call or alarm that the assassin was escaping in a white Mustang going north towards Millington Naval Base. No one ever explained or has ever explained how that call got onto the police radio band. Unless, you were a police officer who had access of some kind to it. So that's another fact. Another issue at hand was that the rumors were rampant around Memphis, that Memphis was going to be the place where King was assassinated. All kinds of stories.
Having invited him, were you afraid at the time?
Not really, because death threats were always the case. I know now many things that I did not know in 1968 or were confirmed in 1968, which should have made me far more suspicious. But I, for an example, did not know on April the 4th that the police detail that became his security people from June of 1966 on, whenever he came to Memphis, had not been detailed. I had a false sense of security because I knew of the special preparations of the police department to see to it that Dr. King could move around Memphis without any kind of assault or attack upon his person. That began in June of 1966, and King was in and out of Memphis on how many occasions, I do not know, between June of 66 and April of 1968, and that detail always met him at the airport because he cooperated with them.
Why was Dr. King staying at the Lorraine Motel?
I think because of the false report. I think because of the attack in the Memphis papers that this civil rights leader was staying at the white motel, luxury hotel, I think was the way it was put, rather than at a perfectly good black motel. But in fact, Martin King, especially with that black police security detailed, rarely stayed at the Lorraine Motel, if ever. They did not like it because it was too open. And as I remember, when he talked with them, when his office called them, to say he was coming to town, they would always urge him to stay at a place like the Rivermont Motel or the Admiral Benbow, both of which they felt were more secure, gave them a better chance of keeping an eye on who was coming in and out.
Was J. Edgar Hoover, William Pepper, behind the push to get him to stay at the Lorraine Motel? Is that your contention?
No, I don't know. I mean, the FBI did distribute. They drafted a press release that went to their friendly media sources around the country. The one that Reverend Lawson's talked about, and so they encouraged that. He never stayed overnight at the Lorraine before. He used to hold community meetings there, and so he did take a room occasionally when he came in. But he never stayed overnight. He always stayed in as Jim said, he always stayed in the Admiral Benbow or the Rivermont. So the more suspicious aspect of that whole stay was that his room was originally 201. It was a courtyard room, and that was secured, and that room was changed, and he 306, and we introduced testimony that indicated that someone from Dr. King's organization called the manager of the hotel and insisted that he be placed in room 306, and that has to be sinister, because the room he was in originally was scheduled to be in was a much more protected and secure room.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we're going to come back with both of you, William Pepper, an attorney, former attorney for James Earl Ray and attorney for the King family, and the Reverend James Lawson, civil rights pioneer, now pastor of the Holman United Methodist Church in Los Angeles. He was one of the people who invited Dr. King to Memphis in 1968, when he was then assassinated. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue on the issue of the King assassination last week, a Memphis jury in a civil trial did say that the King assassination was the result of a conspiracy, not the result of a lone gunman, James Earl Ray, who died last year in prison. We're joined by the Reverend James Lawson of the Holman United Methodist Church, as well as William Pepper, who's an attorney for the King family. William Pepper, the conspiracy that you lay out, do you feel that it has been fully affirmed by this civil trial verdict?
Yes, I think so. To the extent that information and evidence is available was put before this jury. We dealt with after the background section of the case that Jim participated in setting up, we went on to detail the local conspiracy, in detail, ranging from the Liberto involvement, how he approached Jowers.
Liberto being?
Being the local mafia operative connected with the Marcello organization, to the scene of the crime and witnesses who saw people in the brush area, witnesses who saw the shooter go down over the wall, run up the street, get into a Memphis Police Department traffic car and be driven away. We went through that detail of the local conspiracy. Then we moved on to talk about the murder weapon in evidence, why it was not the murder weapon, why it was a throwdown gun that actually was thrown down maybe some 5 minutes before shooting took place.
How did you show that?
By putting two judges on the stand. One, Judge Brown, who had heard the criminal side of the case, the application post-conviction relief for 4 years, became intimately familiar with that weapon. We qualified him as an expert because he is an expert on firearms. He walked the jury through that weapon, holding it on the stand, explaining to them why it was not the murder weapon. For example, the scope on the gun had never been sighted in. It was so off that he said you couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. If you used that scope, the weapon would have fired to the left and down. The death slug metallurgically did not match other evidence bullets that were found in the their composition didn't match other bullets that were found in the evidence bundle. So Joe Brown took them through that. Then we put Judge Haynes on the stand, and Judge Haynes was James Earl Ray's first lawyer. Arthur Haynes, Sr. and Jr. represented James in the first instance. And indicated that he took a statement from Guy Knipe, who owned the store where the bundle, in front of which the bundle was found, and he said Knipe told him that that bundle was dropped some five, he even said 5 to 10 minutes before the actual shooting. So we took him through all of that, and then eventually got into the federal government side of things, put evidence on the stand for the first time ever heard that that there were two Army photographers on the roof of the fire station. They photographed everything. There are films of photographs of this assassination today in existence that show everything. They were taken on the 4th of April. The firehouse captain, Carthel Whedon, told us how he put those guys up on the roof and to enable them to do the photography. Now, isn't it amazing that Carthel Whedon, who was the captain of the fire station, had never before been interviewed by any law enforcement official? Why wouldn't he have been interviewed? Well, he wouldn't have been interviewed because he would have told this story, and then they'd have to go, and they'd have to find those photographs, wouldn't they? And those photographs would have revealed that someone other than James Earl Ray fired the weapon and that the shot came from the bushes, not from the bathroom windows, they've always claimed. So, we want, I mean, this is the, you know, the range of evidence. Memphis Police Department intelligence officer described his role with two federal agents in surveilling, doing covert surveillance and monitoring and bugging of Dr. King when he was there. Another one described how the 111th Military Intelligence Group were in his offices. And then the most powerful testimony perhaps at the trial was from an operative for the former National Security Council agent whose best friend was one of the snipers. They had a backup, military backup sniper team in Memphis, and his best friend was a member of that team. And then we put into evidence through Professor Carson at Stanford working papers of mine that he's received for his archives that set out from another member of the sniper team how the operation was planned. So I think that kind of detail was heard by the jury, and I think it set out the.
Reverend James Lawson, do you feel that this is final proof or vindication of the idea that James Earl Ray, do you contend, also was not the shooter?
Oh, yes. I insist he was not the shooter and knew very little about it and learned much more while he was in prison and when he had the attorneys Mark Lane and then William Pepper. But the point I would make is that I don't consider it final vindication. Final vindication is when the American people are allowed to hear this overwhelming story and evidence and then be permitted to make up their own minds.
What do you think that would take?
Beg pardon?
What do you think that would take?
Well, for one thing, I suppose we have to get a free press who wants to inform the American people. You probably have not seen a single story of the trial where the report indicated who some of the witnesses were and what some of the things were that they said. So that has to be released. So I think that while this is a wonderful major step in the right direction, that the country needs to know covert government in America has assassinated people and maligned people and slandered people in order to prevent them from peacefully carrying on the sort of democratic change and change for justice that the society needs. And I think that's the next step. But this, of course, is by all odds a grand intervening step.
William Pepper, why did Lloyd Jowers want this story out, the businessman who you feel was responsible? Along with others.
Yeah, well, Jowers was boxed in. He's not a volunteer by any means. We had a number of other witnesses who placed him solidly in the frame back in late 92, and he was convinced ultimately that he was going to be indicted. So he went to his lawyer and said, get me immunity and I'll tell everything I know. The state authorities refused to even interview him. never even interviewed this man, much less considered indicting him. But he still felt at risk, and so he then upped the ante and went on a television program and gave a version of his story, only partially complete. And then ultimately he agreed to talk to Dexter King and myself, and Dexter King and Ambassador Young, and he laid the whole thing out at that point in time and in detail, although always maintaining to the King family that he didn't know who was the target. I must say, on the stand, Ambassador Young and Dexter King both said that that's one aspect of his story that they didn't believe. They couldn't imagine how he didn't know. And in an earlier version, it was quite clear that he did know. But it was very difficult for him to face them and indicate that to their faces. So Jowers came forward reluctantly and under pressure and seeking immunity from prosecution.
At the same time that the trial was going on, it was announced that the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial would be built in the mall in Washington, D.C., between the Lincoln and Jefferson monuments. Reverend James Lawson, your reaction to this?
Well, it's I'm quite ambiguous about it, because that's not the memorial he needs. A statue or some other kind of a sculptured response. He needs vindication. He needs the nation hearing the reality of how and why he was assassinated. Needs a repentance on the part of all those forces, including the Memphis Police Department and the FBI, who called him an enemy of the nation and who saw him, in the words of J. Edgar Hoover, as the number one enemy. He needs the repentance of all of those people in the churches, some of whom are noted church leaders today who called him a communist and a dupe of Moscow and the rest of it. So that's the vindication, and that's the memorial Martin King needs. Otherwise, what he stood for, and the fact that he was a symbol for the personal and social transformation of our nation, will get covered over and never permitted to allow the American people to make a decision on behalf of justice.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us, Reverend James Lawson, civil rights pioneer and pastor of the Holman United Methodist Church in Los Angeles, and attorney William Pepper, lawyer for the late James Earl Ray and the attorney for the King family, a civil trial that took place in Memphis and finished up last week, did find that James Earl Ray was not the shooter in the assassination of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Is that an accurate way to put it?
I think that's right. I think the jury heard evidence of James's innocence and effectively exonerated him. He was an unknowing patsy, and I might add I wouldn't have represented James in 1988, 10 years after I became involved in this case, if I hadn't become convinced of that because of my early association and relationship with Martin King back in 1967. The jury exonerated James. He never confessed, by the way. Reverend Lawson's right about that. He took what's known as an Alford plea. He simply copped a plea because he knew his lawyer, Percy Foreman, was not going to give him what he called his best defense. Copped the plea on the 10th of March. On the 13th of March, he took $500 that Foreman had paid him. Foreman paid him $500 to take this plea and cause no trouble at the guilty plea hearing. He took that $500, and they put that in writing, by the way. That's in evidence. Judge's eyes went big and large when he saw that letter from a lawyer to his client. And he took the $500 on March 13th, began a movement to try to set it aside. He tried until the day he died.
The Memphis jury found widespread government conspiracy responsible for the assassination of Dr. King. And that was William Pepper, not only attorney for the King family, but also author of the book Orders to Kill, The Truth Behind the Murder of Martin Luther King. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we talk about another development that took place last week, and that was the battle in Seattle.
You need water for your eyes. Any more water here? You need water for your eyes.
Here, here. Keep your head straight back. Here it is.
You need water for your eyes. Come here. If you have water, come here.
I was sitting down, protesting, singing, "This is a peaceful protest. This is a peaceful protest." And we heard this loud explosion, and all of a sudden, all right next to us, our eyes were burning. We huddled together, and we decided we couldn't stay. As we were leaving, a concussion grenade exploded maybe 6 feet above my head. I still can't hear quite right.
You're listening to the sounds of Seattle for the last week of November, beginning of December. The battle in Seattle that took place when the World Trade Organization Ministerial Summit took place. This past weekend, on Saturday, critics of the embattled Seattle Police Department nearly upstaged a rally of supporters for what the police did. "Hey, hey, ho, ho, police brutality has got to go," demonstrators chanted as city and law enforcement officials took the podium to thank more than 400 citizens packed into the Westlake Park. The Seattle Police Officers Guild staged the rally and was selling Battle of Seattle T-shirts commemorating the events surrounding the WTO talks. But neither the police chief, Norm Stamper, who has said he will now resign, nor the mayor of Seattle, Paul Schell, spoke at the rally. Meanwhile, the governing general council of the World Trade Organization is meeting in special session in Geneva on Friday to consider its next steps after the failure of the WTO meeting in Seattle. And today we're going to talk about just how the people's protest in the streets was organized. You've heard a lot, certainly on Democracy Now!, about what took place, but do you understand how it came into being? Well, today we're going to hear from Brooke Lehman. She is with the Direct Action Network that organized a lot of the street protest, and a group in New York called Reclaim the Streets that held a major protest just a day before the World Trade Organization talks called Buy Nothing Day, where how many people came into the street?
I think there were 400.
400 people came into the street, and it was on the day that's supposed to be the biggest shopping day of the year, the day after Thanksgiving. But Brooke Lehman, why don't you start by telling us what the Direct Action Network is? We've heard really very little about this street-level protest and organizing that took place. We've heard about the protests, but not the level of intensive organizing that was behind it.
Well, the Direct Action Network really came together in July, and it came together around this particular action. The Direct Action Network is a network of student, community, labor, and street theater groups that really were mobilizing to form a collective that could nonviolently and creatively obstruct the WTO Seattle Ministerial.
And why the focus on the WTO?
Well, I think we saw it as a tremendous opportunity to educate people about a lot of the issues that we're all struggling against capital-dominated government. And it really brought together activists from all spectrums of civil society.
And so what did you do? What did you do in July? This certainly wasn't being picked up in the papers.
Well, we began to meet, and a lot of our plans started to come together in September when we spent 10 days together on a farm in northern Washington, about 150 of us, with the Ruckus Society. We had a direct action training camp where we would practice nonviolence training skills, legal skills. We'd talk about radical politics, and we learned how to do banner hangs, and we formed working groups.
Banner hangs?
Yeah. There were a number of banner hangs in Seattle, and that's really what Ruckus specializes in. So we.
What are they?
Banner hangs, basically, you learn how to scale buildings and unfurl, 80-foot banners that make your message clear, because media often doesn't pick up on our message unless we actually visually place it there for them to see it.
We're talking to Brooke Lehman, who is with the Direct Action Network. Even the Washington Post yesterday had a full page kind of post-mortem on Seattle called a Seattle Primer, how not to hold WTO talks. But there was no mention of the Direct Action Network, though there was of other forms of the protest. And so we want to see just how this camp in northern Washington led to the shutdown of Seattle. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is Brooke Lehman of Direct Action Network. So you had this camp in northern Washington. When?
This was in early September.
And how did you organize for Seattle?
Well, essentially the model that we used from the beginning all the way through getting people out of jail was one that utilized the Spokes Council model organizing, where literally you have an inner circle of representatives from working groups that come together, meeting once a day, and members of their group sit behind them coming off the Spokes Council like spokes of a wheel, and they funnel questions through their spokesperson. And that way we can come to consensus in a group that sometimes was around 1,000 people.
And how did this play out actually in the streets of Seattle?
Well, the way we organized, we had a second 10-day convergence where we invited people from all over the world to come together, and we asked that groups come as organized affinity groups, though not all people came as affinity groups. We asked that they at least form when they got there. And we would have meetings once an evening where we would have members of each affinity group sit in the inner circle with their members behind them funneling questions through. And we had people.
This was in Seattle?
This is in Seattle.
The week before?
Yes. And we divided the area around the convention center into pie slices. We literally took a map, and divided the streets up into pie slices. And we had asked the affinity groups to try and form affinity clusters, which would be sometimes 300 people. And we had those affinity clusters make proposals for pie slices. And each night there would be a number of proposals, and the groups would come to consensus in this Spokes Council meeting.
So you divided the convention center area, as you said, in a pie with the pie slices. So you had the entire outer perimeter of the convention center covered?
Right. And different groups would take on a pie slice, and they would be responsible for blockading those particular streets.
And how did they communicate with each other?
Well, we had a communications group and a tactical team, so we had a lot of radios, and each cluster had a communications person working with them.
Medical people?
And we had first aid, we had legal observers and lawyers, we had traffic people. During this week, we had intensive trainings for members of the group to take part in these trainings. So we were asking them that they provide their own services, but we provided the training for those services.
And where did you all stay?
People stayed all over Seattle. There was a lot of community members opened their homes. There was one housing action where activists took over a building to stay. But it was a crunch.
And you had meetings every night of about 1,000 people.
We had meetings all day, but the Spokes Council was every evening.
And the major groups that were involved with the Direct Action Network, which was a coalition of these groups?
Some of the groups were were regional groups. We had Art and Revolution from Arizona and California and Washington. There was the Ruckus Society.
Based
in San Francisco. Reclaim the Streets had a number of people from New York out there. There were Students for a Free Tibet. There was Global Exchange.
In San Francisco.
Yeah, there were all sorts of groups. The Rainforest Action Network.
Did the unions and, for example, Public Citizen, Washington Post focuses a lot on Public Citizen, which was organizing for months in Seattle, Lori Wallach, as well as Mike Dolan, were they involved in the grassroots part of this, the plan to shut down the city and block the delegates from coming into the convention center?
Well, Public Citizen was involved with us in the planning, in planning other actions, but they weren't specifically involved in the shutdown plan. We did have a lot of union participation. We had the steelworkers working with us from the beginning, and now there are a lot of people, a lot of members of both the Teamsters and the Longshoremen who are actively participating in direct action meetings and pursuing a coalition.
It's quite something. It wasn't emphasized very much last week that on that Tuesday, longshoremen shut down ports from San Diego up through Seattle, refused to work for a number of hours.
It was amazing to us, and they were actually prepared to do that again in order to get people out of jail. They were tremendous.
Do you feel that it was a success?
I think that it surpassed all of our dreams of what we could do there. And I think one of the most inspiring moments for me was all the way through the week we had a vigil outside the jail of sometimes 1,000 people, and we continued to have our spokes council meetings outside the jail with a lot of college students who I think had never participated in anything even remotely democratic, breaking up into affinity groups at 2 in the morning. And coming back in a spokes council to decide using consensus decision-making process what we were going to do. And that was really inspiring. You had tons of kids chanting, this is what democracy looks like, at the same time that the WTO was falling apart just streets away over issues of non-democracy and non-transparency.
And what happened when it was announced on Friday night that Charlene Barshefsky, U.S. Trade Representative, and Michael Moore, Director General of the WTO, had said this was it, that the talks had failed?
I think there were people in...
What was the chant?
The chant turned to, this is what democracy feels like, and it turned into a huge dance party. We had African drummers and just incredible celebration all night outside the jail.
Brooke Lehman is with the Direct Action Network, and we're also joined by David Murphy, who is with the Independent Media Center and Democracy Now! Thanks to the Independent Media Center for allowing us to work out of there. And it was quite a remarkable space and goes right along with the Direct Action Network. In fact, the DAN was in there and enabled us to really find out what was happening on the ground at all times. Can you talk about the philosophy behind the Independent Media Network, which provided a lot of the direct coverage, the unmediated coverage, to the really people all over the world? Describe how it worked.
Well, it was actually a coming together of a lot of different grassroots media organizations, and it followed a dream that I think has been in the grassroots media for years, that started really with paper tiger television. And that idea was that, armed with video cameras, that we could go out into the streets and cover the things that were being blocked out by the mainstream media, and really break through that media blockade and reach people with the messages we were trying to get out. As activists, the Independent Media Center had a lot of different components to it. We were producing print media.
It was a newspaper you had once a day.
Yeah, it was a daily newspaper called The Blind Spot. It actually went out. Our distribution was global. I mean, one of the most amazing things about the Independent Media Center is that we were reaching people all over the world.
The website, www.indymedia.org, indymedia.org, how much attention, how many people went to the website?
Right now, I think I talked to our webmaster, and he was, last night, said our count was at roughly 2 million.
2 million. What happened on last Tuesday? The day of the shutdown?
It was roughly 500,000.
On that one day.
On that one day. What this says is that we're competing with the mainstream media. with their grassroots coverage. And what it really says to me is that people don't really trust the mainstream media sources, and they're looking for alternatives.
Well, describe how it worked, because this is what was so phenomenal. You had all these videographers, all these people with tape recorders going out into the street, and then they would bring it back. And how did you use it?
Well, it was uploaded onto the website, but and that was sort of the primary tool for distribution. But that wasn't really what was going on behind the scenes. What you had were reports coming in from all over the world that were solidarity actions on November 30th, and you had people uploading material in Seattle as well. And the way it worked was we had a form that people could basically fill out and drop material onto the site that was completely automated. So while we maintained editorial control and to make sure that the subject stayed on the WTO, people could bring in material from anywhere and upload it. What this meant in real terms was that our newspaper was distributed in paper form, downloaded from our website in Geneva. We had people listening to the radio station in Bangladesh. We had people watching the video clips of the street in Australia. It was the kind of distribution that was happening was amazing. It had never happened before.
We were all involved with a report back from the WTO on Saturday in New York at a community center in the Lower East Side of Manhattan called Chadas. And one of the things you pointed out was this idea of unmediated media, which I really found a profound point.
I was sort of questioning at the end of the week, after being totally burnt out, how effective we really were at providing news that was different than the mainstream media. And our dream really going into creating this was that we would be creating something that was direct, that had the energy of people speaking, that people's inspiration being on the street, that had the information that people weren't getting in the mainstream media. And what I found when I was looking at the material as I was poring over the site at the end of the week was that these were direct, inspired quotes from people. These were people in the streets that had been inspired by the moment. And there was no mediation of the news reporter breaking it down for us. And it really gave the sense of really hearing things. It gave the sense of truth to it, because you had such a diversity of voices speaking about the issues.
So what happens to the indiemedia.org site now?
It's still up, and actually we're getting nearly as many hits as we were at the end of the week.
But a lot of the people have left.
The center itself is continuing on. There are actually two sort of dreams that came out of this. One was that in every city that this independent media center would land, that an independent media center, like a local independent media center, would be created. The other sort of dream that came to a realization in Seattle was that everywhere the WTO landed, or something equally sinister, that the grassroots media would descend on the city and create another independent media center.
So where are you thinking these centers will be set up?
I think a lot of people are looking to the IMF World Bank meetings in April.
In the spring in Washington?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And where else?
May Day in the year 2000 is another one. I mean, there are a lot of possible targets. The Democratic and Republican convention in the summer.
Brooke Lehman, does the Direct Action Network have plans for these events?
I think people would definitely like to converge in Washington, D.C. There also is talk of...
You mean at the IMF World Bank?
At the IMF World Bank, yeah. And also people are looking towards Wall Street. I think a lot of people want to give them what they deserve.
You're here on Wall Street right now.
Right.
That's where WBAI is.
The Direct Action Network is put up a website at thedirectactionnetwork.org, and we're looking to get all the groups that were involved in solidarity actions or who actually were in Seattle to identify themselves so we can mobilize more quickly in the future.
one of the things that most struck me about the protests was how organized they were. There wasn't the sense of chaos for the most part. The thousands of people there, I think the police even saw that very clearly as young people sat down in front of them. They could see the affinity group in operation, see people talking to each other. But what about what the corporate media focused on? Though even the corporate media was forced to go beyond the issue of violence. What was your take on that when glass was broken, for example, some of the windows of Nike Town and FAO Schwartz, Starbucks?
I think that most of us who were there saw how minor a part that was of the actual goings-on. You know, you had 80,000 people in the street and two or three people here and there breaking glass. And I don't think any of us regarded it as violent. And it was interesting to see that I think the majority of the damage was done by young people from the Seattle community. And it was just sort of interesting to see people taking rage out on these corporations that I think are holding a lot of young people hostage with these high price tags, and just people who hadn't been radicalized, sort of just raw anger coming out at these institutions.
And yet, when glass would break, there would be a big chant that would go up, "We are nonviolent, we are nonviolent."
Mm-hmm. That was particularly interesting in the Capitol Hill area. There were a few nights that the police left the zone that they were supposed to be staying in and pushed the protesters up into the Capitol Hill area. And I think what happened there was incredibly dangerous. They were throwing concussion bombs and gas and shooting at a whole bunch of college students. And I was just thinking, if it had happened in New York, some 18-year-old kid would have pulled out a gun and shot back. They were being incredibly irresponsible, and I'm really impressed at the way the kids handled themselves. And every time one of them got out of control at all, you'd hear over the entire crowd, "Nonviolence, nonviolence, nonviolence." So I think that the activists there had a profound effect on the students.
When you had the 1,000-person meetings, when you had the meeting in North Washington, the camp of hundreds of people planning for this, was there a police infiltration? I mean, certainly the police would want to know what was going down.
We always assumed that there was police infiltration. That's why everything we did was completely out in the open. I'm utterly dumbfounded at the fact that our convergence space, which was really our lifeblood, was having this one warehouse space, wasn't ever raided. But
Seattle, large warehouse where many people stayed.
I mean, that was really key to what went on there, and that's why New York organizing is really difficult, because we don't have spaces to be meeting in that are that large. Charis is one of the last.
Finally, David Murphy of the Independent Media Center, where do you go from here in these last 30 seconds?
I'm working with some of the folks that are creating the website to figure out how we're going to build a grassroots media coalition.
You know, Bill Gates Bill Gates didn't realize what the impact of the internet would be just in the world overall, but certainly I bet none of these guys, like Phil Condit of Boeing, et cetera, the host committee, understood the power of the internet at the grassroots level.
Mm-hmm. Actually, one of the most amazing things about the Independent Media Center was our collaboration with the grassroots, and that We had a direct collaboration with the Direct Action Network and other affinity groups that were planning actions. And I think that's really going to continue.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. I think the Direct Action Network and all the groups involved haven't gotten the attention that they certainly deserved in shutting down the city of Seattle. I bet the World Trade Organization, when they meet on Friday to talk about the damage to the WTO, perhaps your name will be mentioned then. 5 seconds.
One other thing that we'd like to mention is that we really need money in the Direct Action Network for people who are still in jail for legal support. So if people want to send in donations, they can send it to P.O. Box 95113, Seattle, Washington, 95113.
And that does it for the show, Democracy Now!, produced by David Love, Maria Carrion, Errol Maitland, our technical director. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.